underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Wally Lamb is the author of four New York Times bestselling novels, Wishin' and Hopin', The Hour I First Believed, I Know This Much Is True, and She's Come Undone. His latest, I'll Take You There, tells the story of film professor Felix Funicello, who is visited by the ghost of trailblazing director Lois Weber from the silent era. Lois invites Felix to revisit and in some cases relive scenes from his past as they are projected on the movie screen. In these magical movies, the medium of film becomes the lens for Felix to reflect on the women who profoundly impacted his life. Again, the name of the new novel is I'll Take You There. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Wally Lamb to this week's book show. Always a pleasure, sir.
Good to see you, Joe.
Thank you very much. What brought you to want to look at, well, basically the importance of women in our lives, but through this lens of film?
It started with a ghost story, actually, that I heard. I had as you mentioned, I had a little book come out called Wishin' and Hopin', and it was made into a movie, and there was a premiere at what had been an old vaudeville theater in New London, Connecticut, called The Guard. While I was there talking to the managers at that theater, they mentioned casually that there had been ghost sightings there. That got me intrigued. I went online and did some research on the Guard Theater and learned that it had started out not only as a vaudeville theater, but also showing silent movies. And they said that the very first one that played there was a Lois Weber film. And I'm thinking, a female director back in that era? There are far fewer female directors in this era. That led me to do some research on Lois Weber, who was indeed a mover and shaker back then.
She was an actress and a director, and as you say, a real mover shaker in the industry.
In the industry, yeah, she was the mayor of I think Beverly Hills, but she also had her own production company, which was very unusual. What sort of kind of angered me a little bit was that I had never heard of her. And whereas, D.W. Griffith and Flo Ziegfeld and all those guys were, are lauded, to this day, a little bit, Mary Pickford too, and United Artists and so forth. Poor Lois had just sort of, she had been one of the biggest of all, and she had kind of faded into the woodwork. So, hearing that there were ghosts in the theater and wanting to do something to honor Lois Weber, I made her a ghost to, interact with my character, Felix.
What are the challenges of writing a ghost story?
Well, for one thing, you got to take a leap into the unknown. I actually had quite a bit of fun with it, and I wasn't particularly intimidated by it. She's not a scary ghost. She is a sort of informing ghost, and she becomes his mentor, particularly on the issue of female, expectations for women and female roles over the years and so forth. So that became probably the major theme of this little novel.
What is it about the particular scenes that are shown, those film canisters that he bumps into, that we get to see those glimpses and allow him to put everything together?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, and this is only sort of me doing cliff notes on my own work here, but when I look back, this is not something when I'm creating the story that I really think about or analyze, but when I got through with it, I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, I'm 66 years old. Of all of my characters, I would say Felix is probably the most like me. I kind of borrow from some things in my own life. And so I think it probably has to do with coming of an age where I'm looking back and trying to figure things out, trying to figure out not only who I have become, but also how I got there.
The idea of looking at the women in his life and the strength of these women through the help of this very interesting, fascinating woman from the silent era. How did that all come together, and what ultimately did you want to explore in that, in the presentation of these three women who are so special to him.
I think one of the antecedents was and has been and continues to be my work with incarcerated women in Connecticut. They have given me an education as I've given them, you know, hopefully an education in how to become more effective writers. I run a volunteer program there. I've done that for about 17 years. They have taken me beyond, I would say, the perimeter of my own, you know, fairly good life. I did not have a bad childhood, but most of these women did. There are certainly feminist issues for people who are incarcerated, particularly, you know, the expectations and the fact that they have kind of flown in the face of what people assign, you know, to women as far as traditions and motherhood and that kind of thing. That was part of it. The other part of it was an old advertising campaign from the 40s and 50s into the 1960s, the storied Miss Rheingold contest. Rheingold was an East Coast beer, and this is considered one of the biggest successes in terms of, you know, the Mad Men era as far as marketing. They ran 6 models every year in this contest. It went from 1940 to 1964. They put ballot boxes in grocery stores and package stores and taverns and so forth. And the public was invited to choose Miss Rheingold. So it was kind of this weird and very successful collision between democracy and sex appeal.
And almost a family activity of picking the next Miss Rheingold.
Totally, yeah. I mean, kids could vote early and often as well as adults. And really, it was pretty cool because it was something, you know, I remember voting as a kid in this election, and nobody had ever asked my opinion about anything.
I know we've discussed your work of incarcerated women, and so I had to chuckle early on in the novel because Lois Weber has seen Orange is the New Black.
Right.
And has some very clear thoughts on that.
Right. And ironically, I have not ever seen Orange is the New Black now. You know, because I'm not quite sure why I purposely avoid it. But and it's funny because the women that I work with, you know, they haven't seen it either because there is no, you know, cable at the prison. But, you know, they're very dismissive and they say, oh, you know, that's based on, you know, the federal prison in Danbury. That's a country club compared to where we are.
Talk to us a little bit about the women that are important in Felix's life and what they have in common and how they are so very different as well.
Well, one of the three central female characters is Felix's sister Frances. He has two sisters. Simone is the older and more beautiful one. Frances is the sort of also ran, kind of like a Marsha kind of thing with Jan. But Frances is overweight, and she's, you know, just sort of she's not going to be able to compete for, you know, that sort of 1950s kind of beauty thing. She is more about substance than style. I placed her as somebody who, you know, who with few options back in the growing up in the 50s, and so she really attaches to this Miss Rheingold contest. She begins campaigning for, you know, her favorite and so forth, and so, you know, of course, in, you know, that, yeah, you know, that Miss Rheingold thing was, you know, it was all about style, not substance. So she's an interesting character. She later develops anorexia nervosa that kind of almost takes the family down for a while. Mm. In addition to Francis, there is his daughter, Felix, who in Wishin' and Hopin' was a fifth grader, is now a 60-year-old professor of film studies. And he has a daughter, a millennial-age daughter. And one of the things that was fun was to try to create her character. Now, I have millennial-age kids, but they're sons. I've always wanted to have a daughter, and the closest I came was our golden retriever, Echo, who I always thought of as a kind of a daughter. So I, even though I didn't have my own daughter, I gave Felix one and grew her up into a very modern feminist, unlike her second-generation feminist mother, who was, you know, sort of active in feminism during the 70s. One of the things that I found in my research and by talking to my kids and their friends is that there is a real difference between 21st century feminism as opposed to 20th century feminism, as there was, you know, a difference between that and, you know, the suffrage movement. So so that became she became the other, you know, the other female character. And then, of course, Lois Weber, who was sort of forgotten because she was a female.
I love the character of the daughter. Swears like a truck driver.
Yeah. Well, she is a New Yorker after all. she learned how to use those terrible words in New York. And at one point, Felix says to her, you know, you're starting to sound like an HBO character. And that's not meant as a compliment.
There is a point in the novel where she discusses those differences, because really it's she who understands the differences in feminism and in the different eras mm-hmm. of feminism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I made Eliza, her name is, his daughter, is she's a contemporary writer. She works for New York Magazine right. in this fiction. And she's assigned an article for their yesteryear issue on this old beauty contest, the Miss Rangel contest. And she's sort of horrified by this. But she also writes a blog called Invincible Girl, G-R-R-R-L, in which she talks about modern feminism. So when I sat down and had to write the blog that my Eliza, I imagine, would write, that sort of opened my eyes to all kinds of things about, everything from Tinder to, polyamory and slut shaming and some of the global initiatives that 21st century feminists can grab a hold of because of the internet.
Wally Lamb is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is I'll Take You There. This also it's printed as a book, but it is also a meta book as well, which is a little bit of everything. You access it as an app, mm-hmm. and then it will do all kinds of magical things. Talk a little bit about how you came to that project.
Well, actually, that project came to me. I had lunch with a guy who had been in his early career a novelist. When my first novel, She's Come Undone, came out, this guy whose name is Ken Simon he had also just come out with a first novelist. So we actually did a reading together back in, I guess it was 1992. And, so decades go by, and now he's doing this meta book thing, and he showed me a prototype where he had taken a very famous book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, the John Berendt book, and sort of enhanced the reading experience. What he showed me was not only that, it had electronic text that you could read on your, on your device, but also there was a little documentary stuff. You know, you could take all these side trips. One of the reasons why I wanted to try this and experiment with it a little bit is when I see my own kids, my sons, the way that they take in media differently than I do and my wife. When they come home for Christmas or whatever, you know, they can sit there with listening to their iPod, watching, Sports Channel or ESPN, and seeing something online, either doing email or reading something online and so forth. So I kind of wanted to see if maybe I could lure, younger readers into a story where, it's not just a reading experience, but it's probably an enhanced reading experience.
So it's an app. It's a movie, a soundtrack. There's a little bit of everything. You can read it. You can have this wonderful cast with Kathleen Turner, and there's even an Elizabeth Banks film. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah. Yeah, the audio drama is sort of like the radio days. So you can read the text. You can listen along with it to these, not just a single narrator, but, performers sort of taking on the various parts and so forth. Jeremy Sisto is in it, and Dana Delaney, and Laura Benanti, Broadway star. And so it's sort of, when I read a when I read a book, I tend to read books with covers and pages. My wife is a switch hitter. She can go back and forth between the two. But whereas she will take a break between chapters and look up a word or, look up, something on Wikipedia that's mentioned in the book, I like to just sort of immerse myself in the story. And then later on when I finish the book, I can do that. But I wanted to have the option for readers of all kinds to sort of, adapt their own style and take in the story. Hopefully, that's the dominant thing, to immerse yourself in the story, but also go down these alleys and avenues as they wish and, when they wish.
Obviously, the story itself lends itself wonderfully to that format and to that experiment, if you will. Was it a challenge at all? Did you have to write any differently, knowing that that would be something that you would do in the back of your mind?
No, I wasn't. In fact, I was encouraged by the MetaBook guys to, just think in terms of the novel as a novel. Mm. And they said it was fun because later on, when I was done with draft 4 or 5 or whatever, and I had editorial advice all the way through it, but then. That was the time that we began to play with the, with the enhancements, but not, it was not part of the, the original creative process.
So they catch up with you. You don't have to catch up with them.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess that brings us to a discussion of where we are in the state of the novel and how you feel about that.
Mm-hmm. I think that storytelling is very primal. It goes back before the invention of the printing press when, people used to go around and, sit in campfires and tell each other stories. I grew up in a big Italian family, and I remember one of the best things about holidays when I was a kid was sneaking under the adult table at my grandmother's and listening to the stories. The adults didn't realize that I was there. I heard all kinds of things, funny stories, sad stories, things that, sometimes are filtered from kids, from kids' ears and so forth. Storytelling of all kinds has interested me. And I think that's the basic human need, is to tell stories or be told stories that sort of investigate and maybe illuminate the human condition. So it really doesn't matter so much to me whether that is in the form of a book or an episode on television or somebody telling somebody else a story on the subway and I'm eavesdropping next to them, whatever. So that's what I feel about that.
Did you know all along that it would be relatively short? I mean, some of your work has been 900 pages.
Yeah, right. I was sort of relieved when I figured that, okay, I have told this story now. I probably will go on next to a longer and more involved story with backstory and, a lot deeper character development. But no, this was sort of, I think because Wishin' and Hopin' was a light, nostalgic story. Prior to that, I had written something called The Hour I First Believed, right, which really deals with life's deep issues and deep complications. It begins with the Columbine shooting. And I just, that was a long, tough novel to write. I ended up having something that was diagnosed as vicarious traumatization, almost as if I had lived the Columbine tragedy instead of just researching, relentlessly. So when I sort of finished that book, I kind of wanted to remind myself that you can walk on the sunny side of the street as well. So there came Wishin' and Hopin', which is a short book. My next book, We Are Water, was a longer book, more serious themes. And then I kind of wanted to go back and revisit the Funicello family, Felix and his gang. Although, tonally, this is a little bit different than Wishin' and Hopin'. It's more serious, and it goes into, some of the darker recesses that Wishin' and Hopin' did not go into.
That idea of coming so close to a subject that it affects you mentally and physically, mm-hmm. that had to have been quite a shock. Or did you realize that it was happening as it was happening?
I didn't. I did, but I, It was just a really, I was having a very difficult time starting it because, you know, I had just come off with two wonderful rides on the roller coaster with the Oprah Book Club, endorsements. And so, but, you know, that kind of wonderful success becomes a double-edged sword when, okay, now you've got to write something else, and you have millions of readers now who are waiting for you to write something. So I shut down for a while. I couldn't, I was too afraid to write the first sentence because I didn't want to disappoint people. And I had to learn how to kind of shoo all those expectations out of my writing room and start again. Of course, you know, what do I start with? But, you know, an American tragedy. Mm-hmm. It was difficult, very difficult to start that novel. It was challenging and hard all the way through. And that's when I was struggling midway through it. That's when I checked in with a psychologist, and he said, "Yeah, I'm going to diagnose that you have vicarious traumatization," and he said, "That is an occupational hazard for those of us in psychology, because people come to us with their problems and their troubles, and lots of times it's almost that we're identifying with those problems that we ourselves have not necessarily lived through.
You take them home.
Yeah, yeah.
Did it ever extrapolate to the point of where you were concerned that it would be a challenge for the reader?
I was concerned about that, but I kind of had to think selfishly and say, well, okay, this is what I need to write about. You know, I had been a high school teacher myself for 25 years, and, the Columbine kids, Klebold and Harris, they were baffling to me. And, of course, Dave Sanders, the teacher who was one of their victims, you know, I felt a real strong allegiance and affinity with him. And so I needed to go there. I just needed to, and it was scary to do that. But I figured I worked once upon a time with a wonderful writing teacher named Gladys Swan, and she said to me, she gave me great advice all the way through the time that I was working with her. But she said, "You know, Wally," she said, "you have to write the book for yourself, and then have the faith that the audience that is meant to find it will find it." So whether that audience was going to be a small one or a larger one, I had to be true to my own curiosity and then hope for the best in terms of audience.
Did that have an impact in trying to process what happened at Newtown?
Yeah, Newtown came after that, several years after. But I did find that I had to tiptoe around Newtown. I spoke at one of the memorials for one of the teachers who had been killed. But I had to kind of go carefully, and I was approached by some media that knew that I had written about Columbine. But I had to say to myself, you know, take care of yourself here. You don't want to sort of be a mouthpiece for this kind of thing. It would have been too hard for me to do that.
So a book like this feels good to you, then? I'll take you there.
Yeah, it was an easier book to have written. One of the big perks for me is that when I come out of a book, when I emerge from the process, if you will, I emerge having learned things that I didn't know before, and that's a really cool thing for me. You know, when I wrote She's Come Undone, I learned a hell of a lot about women that I hadn't known before. When I wrote I Know This Much Is True, I had nothing but surface knowledge of, paranoid schizophrenia or mental illness in the family and so forth. So that for me, that's one of the best things. And the second best thing is getting letters from people. You know, I invent these stories and I come up with these characters, and then I get these wonderful letters from readers who say, "You made me feel less alone. How did you know my story? How did you know my family's story?" And those are real gifts to me. I keep all of those letters. I write back and so forth.
Wally Lamb's new novel is I'll Take You There. It is published by Harper, also available as an app through Apple. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows, and you can email us at book@wamc.org. Wally Lamb, a great pleasure to have you on the program as always.
Well, that pleasure goes back right to you, Joe. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Special thanks to Paul Ruest and Argo Studios in Manhattan. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.